Hi, welcome to Marketing Sherpa's Email Marketing Metrics teleconference this afternoon. This is Ann Holland. I'm the publisher here at Marketing Sherpa, and I have our metrics editor, Stefan Tornquist, here with me this afternoon. Hey, Stefan.
Hi, Ann.
Everyone listening, you should have received a new PDF link. It would have been around noon today, East Coast time, in your email, which has the updated version of the PowerPoint slides that we'll be talking to today. If for some reason you didn't get the email or you haven't had a chance to go through your email and find the darn thing, please zap over an email to johnw@marketingsherpa.com. He is standing by to zap out additional copies to anybody who needs them. It is a fairly simple, I think it's a 15-page PDF. It's a fairly short thing. It shouldn't be that hard for you to download. So go right ahead and email out to johnw@marketingsherpa.com. Now, in the meantime, Stefan, I'm so excited to be talking about numbers with you today. You just spent, the past 4 months doing nothing but looking at every bit of data in the history of mankind on email marketing?
Well, it may not have been quite 4 months. It certainly felt like it. We're in a wonderful situation to be able to consult with a wide variety of sources, both internal and external, and I'm really very happy with the breadth of the data that we've been able to collect.
That's great. And, of course, so many Marketing Sherpa readers were submitting their own information, which makes a huge difference, with the community being able to help the community.
Absolutely. Some of the best suggestions we've had for future research have come from the participants in the survey.
Oh, cool. Now, I know we got, I think it was over 500 people submitted questions for today's teleseminar. Stefan has made sure that the slides that we'll be presenting today talk to almost every question, and then we'll address some of the questions that aren't specifically addressed at the end of this seminar. If, however, there's something that you still didn't get answered about email metrics that is something that we can't find the answer to easily in the things we're presenting today, or it's not on the email metrics guide, absolutely do zap Stefan a note. Stefan, what's your email address here?
My email address is Stefan T, S-T-E-F-A-N-T, @marketingsherpa.com.
Great, and we're here, obviously, to help you guys. If we could all turn to page 3 of the PDF that you received, and again, if you did not get the PDF of today's presentation, please zap an email to johnw@marketingsherpa.com, and then you can go off and get that. On page 3, this is your first chart, Stefan, the interactive budget shifts for 2003 to 2004. What's interesting about this chart?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is that email marketing really holds its own, even as other kinds of marketing are more, hip, shall we say. I mean, certainly a lot of the attention over the past year has been on search marketing, and it should be there. But at the same time, marketers who have been around using online advertising and marketing for the past 5 years know that email marketing is really the workhorse of many kinds of campaign. And the tiny percentage, only 7% of marketers do not use some kind of email marketing.
That's cool. Now, we actually conducted that survey on behalf of AdTech last December, and we will be reconducting it this year to the AdTech attendee list. And we will have fresh data for all of you in Marketing Sherpa's newsletter. We're going to be publishing that in mid-January. So everybody look for that. That'll come out for free, which will be very interesting. Why don't we move on to page 4 of our presentation? This is what marketers said they're planning for 2005. Stefan, what are your talking points on this particular chart? What really struck you about this?
Well, I think that overall the one thing that strikes one looking at 1 year versus past years, and now we've been doing this for a while, so we have the luxury of looking back. Overall, you can see that marketers have great intentions to spend time and money researching their results and their processes, and that often that's not possible. You see a consistent desire year after year, and one of the suggestions we have is to, instead of trying to improve every aspect of your marketing at the same time, to really focus on what's important. And one of the things that this slide shows is that there are certain tactics, campaign-specific landing pages, for instance,
mm-hmm.
And we'll see a little bit more about this with testing in a moment, that that really matter. Another one that I know is a favorite of yours is using automated events. And one thing that we saw this year was that B2B is beginning to use the automated and triggered campaign elements, something that had really been the domain of B2C.
What would an example of that be?
Well, in the B2B case, something we found anecdotally is the use of automated triggers to respond with a real piece of content when someone signs up for a newsletter. So instead of the traditional simple thank you email, people are including white papers, pieces of really good content to immediately provide a value to the subscriber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I know that one marketer I was talking to recently said that they had gone through their past email newsletter issues for the past couple of years and dug out their absolute best of articles, the ones that had gotten the most people to email in or write in, the ones that the sales reps had said really seemed to make people really excited, you know, stuff that was still evergreen, and actually turned that into an automated kind of series of six emails over several weeks that new opt-ins got, so that they kind of went out there, they weren't just getting the regular newsletter, they were getting the absolute best of to kind of charm them when they were fresh, hot prospects. Thought that was kind of interesting, and of course the new prospects hadn't seen the old stuff, so it was great to reuse it. One thing I'm noticing here is how many people are planning to increase their use of co-registration. And of course, I've been a big fan of co-registration for a long time, and I'm seeing it in a lot of places. The thing I think that people could do here perhaps a little better is, again, use those welcome messages and really specialize them per co-registration partner, so that if someone signs up for your email newsletter or your white paper or your special alerts, sales alerts list, if they're on a third-party site and they say, oh, yeah, also send me this thing, they get a welcome message that immediately cites and says, you know, thank you for signing up on, you know, here's the name of the third-party site, and, you know, so they remember. I know we found with our co-registration that people often, either they get confused, I think they're even business executives, they get confused. They think, well, if I sign up at the Wall Street Journal, then I think this is a Wall Street Journal thing, even though it's actually from you, and then they suddenly think you're spamming them. Or they may just sort of forget. It's easy for confusion, and right now when we're fighting to stay out of spam filters, it's real important to make people understand, yeah, you did sign up, you did sign up.
That's absolutely right, it's important at the that all those things are set out at the beginning of the relationship, so that when someone unsubscribes from one email later, from one email newsletter later in the process, and then receives one of the co-reg newsletters, that they're not surprised, that they don't assume that they've opted out of everything.
That's a really good point, too. Yeah. Now, it's interesting here. I'm seeing that 33% say they're going to increase advertising in third-party email newsletters. When I talk to the people on the newsletter front, though, and the marketers who are heavy email newsletter advertisers, I'm hearing about people being sold out, that this is something that, although our survey showed, well, that some increase, 33% increase in spending, that may be harder to increase your spending than you think.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
The, I mean, one theory, I know you and I have talked about it, on why this is a tactic that people are exploring and wanting to explore, is the consistent drop in response rates from rented third-party email lists.
Mm-hmm.
So as an acquisition tool, good third-party newsletters are a great way of building the relationship.
Mm-hmm. I may be, and also I may be more likely to open something that I perceive to be valuable information than something I perceive to be promotional information. So maybe they're getting better open rates than the average sales alert. Well, why don't we move on to the next slide, which is page 5. And again, if anyone's joined us since I last made this announcement, if you have not got the copy of the slides, there was a new PDF that we sent out today around noon East Coast time, just zap an email over to John. That's johnw@marketingsherpa.com, and he will very happily and quickly send you a copy of the PDF with all of our charts and everything on it, no problem. And yes, you can share this PDF of charts with your coworkers. Well, now, Stefan, we're looking at page 5, which is something that we get a lot of questions on. What email variables do B2B marketers test? Now, real quick, you decided to put the B2B marketers in here because we have so many B2B marketers who are here today. But these variables, was this fairly similar for B2C marketers as well?
It was largely. I think one area where you see less testing in the B2B world is the from name. And that's probably because they have very set company practices. But by and large, yes, these tactics are tested to roughly the same degree and with roughly the same response.
Okay. Well, of course, the questions we get asked are long copy versus short copy. A lot of people say, should I do long copy versus short copy? Were you surprised by this particular answer here?
To the extent that people don't plan on testing?
Yeah, because we get a lot of questions which one works.
I know, that's very true. At the same time, I think those one-third that don't plan to test may have done the testing in the past and found that it really depends campaign to campaign.
Mm-hmm.
There's no question that there are certain products and certain tones to a campaign that that warrant and benefit from long copy.
Mm-hmm.
That's an axiom that we've found to be true. At the same time, sometimes simple is better.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the HTML versus text, this is actually, if someone had told me 3 years ago that this was still a big issue, I would have laughed at them because I thought didn't we all settle this in 2001? You know, everyone knows HTML is better. But, of course, the world has changed a great deal, and now I think this is a much more viable test maybe than it's been in the past few years, HTML versus text. I think in particular, if you're in B2B, there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them being that, of course, the spam filter thing. HTML may be the only way you're going to get through certain spam filters. Sorry, HTML, bailing on HTML and having text only may be the only way you're going to get through certain spam filters, in particular if you're mailing into people at work emails, at corporate emails, because they tend to ban HTML much more than large ISPs do. So if you are mailing into people at work, text only may be the only way to get through to some companies. And then, of course, if you're mailing to anyone in very large institutions or the federal government who tend to use Lotus Notes as their email platform to receive email, they can't read HTML. Most of them can't. And so you got to send in a text. One thing I've noticed in B2B in particular is that I'll ask B2B marketers, well, why did you decide? How did you make your decision to go with HTML? And more often than not, the answer is, oh, I thought it looked more professional. And that's not a good answer. To me, the answer is we tested it and it worked better. Or, we have something like a chart or a graph that is extremely valuable yet visual, must be presented visually, that we really, really need to put in the newsletter. But if you're just putting your big honking logo and maybe some clip art, there's really no reason to waste that. And indeed, some people at work some people open up HTML and just see the glossy whatever and it looks like an ad and just bail on it. So people may be HTML'd out in corporations. Now, of course, if you're in e-retail, those big pictures are what gets the sale. So
Although it will be interesting mm-hmm. on the B2C side to see what, if any, impact the image blocking in Gmail has. I've heard from several people in the space that that they're worried about how consumers look at their email when a number of images are blocked. As most out there probably know, Gmail simply reports that an image has been blocked, and while it allows the user to turn them on,
It's
going to
by
be interesting
message.
To see from a from a usability standpoint how consumers respond to image heavy emails inside of Gmail.
Now, this image blocking is not Gmail only. It's the newer versions of Outlook and AOL are also doing some type of image blocking, are they not?
That's right. I haven't seen the new version of AOL, but Gmail's is the most aggressive because it's the default. And you're absolutely right about Outlook.
And Outlook, of course, is used by more than 40% of email recipients in the world, so that's huge news, you know, as they migrate over to the newer versions. One thing I think is interesting is if your click here, you know, but it is an image, you're in trouble. You know? So wherever you do have a hot link, be sure that you have something that actually is a spelled out link somewhere near it. And it's funny, people don't think about that anymore. But you need that, especially if it's a button or perhaps, you know, the words click here and, you know, giant type or something that's done as an image instead of text. People may be interested in responding and they just can't. Now, how is this image blocking affecting metrics, though? Is it affecting your open rate metrics? Because, of course, the OpenPika, the open rate thing that reports back is an image serving thing.
My understanding is that it does not affect the recording of an open. But there are so many other things which affect an open that I would be the first to caution open rate. In fact, we might as well move along to the next slide.
Okay, great. Yeah, let's move to slide number six.
We address open rates.
Oh, open rates. Yeah, perfect.
I certainly don't want to underestimate the importance of open rate as a benchmark, but in terms of its measurement of success, the fact that so many email clients will report an email is opened when it hasn't in fact been read, it's a suspect metric, as I think most people know. Unfortunately, it's one of the easiest ones to get, so I don't think we'll be improving on it dramatically anytime soon, but
Well, I know one thing a lot of people will tell me when they write in about their campaigns or I talk to them on the phone about their campaigns, they'll say, well, of the emails that were read, and immediately, if you're using the word the emails that were read, that's hugely suspect because, of course, you don't know they were read. You have no idea they were read. It's sort of like saying, well, of the emails that were delivered, and I'm just like, okay, you have no idea what you're talking about because you don't know how many were delivered. You just don't. So there is no red metric, I mean, I guess unless it's read and responded to, but there's no red metric out there at all. What did you see here in terms of open rates year over year? We've been tracking this for a few years now. When you created this chart, Stefan, what did you notice? Has stuff really changed?
It hasn't changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. In fact, the shift... if we want to actually go to the next slide, the click-through rate trends, the same pattern which has developed around open rates is developing around click-through rates, which is there is a shift down, but mm-hmm. that shift is largely from the very top end, let's say in click-through, those who are getting 21%. About 25% fewer email newsletters are seeing response rates or click-through rates above 21%.
Mm-hmm.
But at the lower end of the spectrum, you don't see as much of a shift.
In other words, if you were doing really badly before, you're still doing really badly?
One way of looking at it. And if you were doing really well before, likely you're still doing pretty well. And
I see. So if you were doing really well before, you have fallen, but you've sort of fallen in with everyone else in the middle. And that
right.
middle seems to be holding steady.
Right. And, of course, this is just one very particular slice. This chart is of B2B click rates to the house list.
Mm-hmm.
And we test a wide variety of different kinds of campaign and different audience types.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, what you see is a falling in towards the middle. And we think that's a pretty good thing.
Okay.
This is email newsletters are no longer a new sexy marketing tool. They are a reliable marketing tool, and as such, they're getting response rates that have fallen, but have found their steady floor, if you will.
Mm-hmm. When you looked at these click rates versus the open rates, were people measuring a click rate of total emails sent, or were these click rates the clicks out of the opens that were measured?
This is of total.
Of total email sent.
This comes from
our survey. Not delivered, but of sent.
Right. And that's an issue that we address at several points in the report,
mm-hmm.
Because, of course, not every vendor chooses to measure open and click with the same, using total as the denominator. Many choose to remove undelivered emails from the equation. And it's the complexity of that equation that that's really the basis for our preferring to simply use the total sent,
mm-hmm.
Because there's no debate about what that number is. Whereas depending on who's doing the tracking, what is a soft bounce, what is a hard bounce, which get included, which don't, can be very complex. And I have talked to many people in the industry, people who are experts in deliverability even, who are real advocates for using total sent because it is an indisputable number.
Okay. One thing I know that some people have been talking about now is don't just look at your click rate, but if you are doing HTML mailing, of course the only way you can track open rates is if you're doing HTML mailing. If you are doing HTML mailing, look at your clicks as a percent of opens. And again, opens aren't perfect, but if you look at your clicks as a percent of opens, it tells you really of the people who perhaps read it, how many of them chose to click. And that's, in a way, a more interesting metric than out of total sent, and God knows how many even got through or opened, how many chose to click. And that kind of that ratio is very interesting.
That's absolutely right. The ratio does speak to the quality of content
mm-hmm.
better than either of the metrics separately.
Mm-hmm. What were the sorts of things that got the worst click-throughs that you found from analyzing Marketing Sherpa data?
Oh, well, there's no question that sales emails to rented lists
mm-hmm.
for the specifically in B2C, but really across the board,
mm-hmm.
That rented lists in the B2B space really underperformed and caused problems in some cases.
And what were the things that got the best clicks in general? Was it the how, obviously it was house lists because they tend to be, you have a relationship with the people and they tend to click on you.
Sure, it's house lists.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, it's interesting that when you look at ultimate conversion rate,
mm-hmm.
Some simple sales blasts to the house list performed as well as embedding them in newsletters and putting more content around it.
Well, why don't we move on to page 8 of our handout and look at a chart for sample conversion rate. Now, I know you collected a whole bunch of different conversion rates, but
right.
this is
one of
one interest wing.
Many,
yeah.
many charts.
But this is one that, I mean, it's free offers, and I think a lot of people have free offers. Maybe they have a sweepstakes or they have a, you know, sign up to get my newsletter or register for XYZ, and obviously a lot of people are doing that because they're hoping to gather more opt-ins so they have a better house list. So here they are sending a free offer to their house list. And it's what's interesting is, now, just to clarify, these are of the people who clicked, what percent converted? This is not of the people we sent to, what percent converted?
Correct. These are the of the people arriving via click.
Mm-hmm. So if 100 people clicked through on your email that you sent to your house list with the free offer, of those 100 people, 23% of marketers said that only 2 to 3.9 people ended up converting to the free offer?
That's right.
That's really, that's, that I don't think that's shockingly low because I do way too many case studies on this, but do you think that's going to surprise a lot of marketers that hey, it's free. Why wouldn't they take it?
Well, there are a lot of free offers these days.
Mm-hmm.
I think that looking at the conversion rate charts that we have across a wide variety of audience and type of offer, these are among the best you're going to see, as you would
really?
Expect. This chart doesn't resemble many of the conversion rate charts, which really are weighted at the lower end of the scale.
Wow.
Heavily weighted.
No, I know that we've shown other ones where if it's a B2B free offer, I think the average for that was around 6% for I believe it was a search, if you're doing search marketing and it was a free offer, it was around 6% would actually take the free offer even after they click through. What this points to me, though, is that with your email offer, yeah, they've read about it in the email. You did great sales copy in the email. You got them to click. It tells me you still have to keep on selling on your landing page, that you can't count on the email to do the heavy lifting of the free offer or even the paid offer conversion for you, that no matter how well you did in the email, the only thing you got from that email was a click. You know, so the subject line, the only thing you got from your subject line was an open. The only thing you got from your email newsletter was a click. And now to get the conversion, you yet again have to flex your muscle and work very hard. And the harder you work, it's just astronomical how much better you can get. I know that earlier on in these charts, it showed that 61% of marketers were hoping to spend more on customized landing pages for email campaigns this year. We actually saw almost an identical number, wasn't it, last year from marketers who all hoped to spend more money on customized landing pages.
Right.
This kind of data shows me that a lot of them probably weren't able to. Maybe their CEO didn't let them. Maybe they got busy and diverted money to other campaigns. Maybe there was no time. I mean, you know how it is. But this chart is the one telling me spend the money. And
that's absolutely right. And that's the easiest place to spend your money because there are a lot of things that will affect your response rate and your knowledge about it.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that the people who are seeing very high conversion rates are also those that know the most about their customers and what their customers are doing over time, for instance,
mm-hmm.
Not just in that one session, but does that person come back later and convert? Does that person use a different channel to convert? Getting that kind of information is time-consuming and it's expensive. Making sure that you have a landing page that is focused is something that any marketer has the resources to do.
Yeah, either outsource it or if your in-house web team can't do it or do it yourself. And, of course, the key thing for these landing pages for email is I think a lot of people, especially if you've got an agency or a vendor doing your landing page for you, they often will only leave it up for a few months and then they'll wipe that puppy from their files. And I know a lot of people have told me you may not get a lot of clicks a few weeks or a few months later, but you may get clicks, and you want to leave those landing pages up as long as you humanly can. And server space is cheap. Why not just leave a whole, even if it's outdated, fine. Send them to something else. Maybe send them, sorry, this offer is no longer available, but here's another one. Just leave that page up because those very, very, very late clicks apparently convert better than anyone else. They've bothered to save the message. They've bothered to dig it out now that they're ready to buy. And you don't want that click going nowhere, you might as well grab it.
Well, and old landing pages are very frequently where people get to from a very specific search.
Mm-hmm.
And those people are, if they're searching specifically, then they're ready to buy. You're absolutely right that although there aren't many clicks, we've got a chart in the report that shows that while 90% of your clicks are very quick, you know, one day, 2 days,
mm-hmm.
the chain almost never ends. You approach zero but never quite get there.
Mm-hmm. You dribble, drabble in forever.
It takes a long time.
Yeah. I know one thing we've noticed, I guess it's 5 years now, when we look at our site stats over the holidays, and I always thought kind of initially that we would get nobody clicking on articles or anything on the holidays, but I can actually tell when we look at our site stats that pretty much when everybody has gotten up from Thanksgiving dinner, because a lot of people, I think a lot of Marketing Sherpa readers, we always see this leap around 4 o'clock in the afternoon to 5 o'clock on Thanksgiving Day. Suddenly you'll have a whole bunch of people suddenly going into old Marketing Sherpa articles, and I think they've been holding on to their newsletters for a long time. The family's kind of gotten to them. They're like, I need a little alone time. They go in the home office, and they think, well, I don't want to actually do work because it's the holiday, so, hey, I'll read some old newsletters. And I always see this kind of whoop, this lift. You can actually see it go across the time zones on the coast. Oh, California's gotten up from their meal. So it's pretty funny, and I know that often they're very old newsletters.
That's
so
interesting. I think the
it's all out there.
I'm not sure if later in the report, when we look at delivery by day of week and results by day of week, whether it includes the weekend. But you also there are very unusual statistics that come out of the weekend. It's the best of times and the worst of times.
Is it like search marketing, where you may have a lower conversion rate, but it's still worth doing because maybe they're researching and then they plan to come back and buy in the week when they have their approval?
Or conversely, you might have a very high conversion rate but an extremely low open rate.
That's interesting. Why don't we move on to slide 9, which is all about basically spam filters, which was the number one thing people asked about when they were signing up for this teleseminar. How are spam filters affecting things? And the reason I actually asked you to include this particular slide in the presentation was that the whole 20% number gets used a lot. People say, oh, well, we asked, the 20% of emails filtered. The thing is, that official number, which has come out from several different filter measurement firms, does not include corporate filters and does not include user-end filters. So it's all that includes is the big ISPs. They say, oh, this is how much gets filtered at AOL, or this is how much, when Earthlink gets a bunch of email, approximately 20% is filtered out as spam before it hits the users. But after it goes through those ISPs and 20% of the worst spam is kind of sliced off, then there's an additional filtering that's happening either at the corporate level, if you're going to a work email address, or at the personal level, if you're going to a personal email address and that person just happens to have perhaps purchased some software that's doing some filtering, or maybe they set their Outlook on filter or something. So there's additional filtering. So 20% is your baseline. It's probably going to be a lot more than that. When you look at how corporations filter email, and of course, they filter a great deal because the CEO or someone says, hey, we're getting spam here. This is wasting my workers' time. Stop it. And the IT department hates spam and doesn't like advertising much either and says, well, let's stop that. And they get all gung-ho and they start slamming filters in. And, hey, they're heroes for doing so. They're not often real concerned about false positive rates. In fact, it's interesting. I was looking at reviews of spam filters that were available for corporations. I was looking at the reviews on Forbes, and they've got a technology newsletter. And it was interesting, not one of the reviews mentioned the false positive rate as anything ever. They didn't even come up. None of them said, oh, and by the way, this filter may filter some good email by mistake. None of them. They just sort of said, this is how much spam it's going to get rid of. So I don't think the IT guy who's choosing the spam filter technology is looking at it and going, oh, I better make sure this doesn't filter any good email. Permission email that people want. He's just going, how much spam can I get rid of? And as we see here, it seems to be people are really using the corporate filters. The ones that are the worst, I guess it's Spam Assassin, which is an open source application, Public Blacklists in particular, and rules that are kind of independently created.
Right. I would say of these, the worst are the other rules I create.
Yeah, and the blacklist, because, let's face it, we know a lot of companies who are perfectly good permission mailers who have been blacklisted. We've been blacklisted.
Right.
Microsoft has been blacklisted. Land's End's been blacklisted. All good, decent, permission-only mailers get blacklisted. It happens. By mistake, and then, you work to correct it. Public blacklists are infamous for having mistakes on them. So, and here are the corporations relying on them to filter your stuff out. Now, talk to me about these rules. Why are you worried about the rules?
Well, because they're so unpredictable, and because the psychology of someone who's tasked with getting rid of spam is to get rid of spam and to do so very aggressively. As a result, the false positive issue isn't really an issue except to the kinds of people who are on this call. Mm-hmm. The good news, I think, is that efforts like this tend to be cyclical, and there is going to be a response to the overzealous pursuit of spam, especially
know, really?
In corporate. I think so. Because, well, let's see. I was going to use a Janet Jackson analogy, but perhaps I better stay away from that. It was really more of an FCC analogy. In any case, the in the corporate environment, as we've been hearing about percentages of false positives as high as 40%.
Mm-hmm.
And sooner or later, that is going to start affecting what people are asking for from their IT departments.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know that some marketers I've talked to are saying that they're resorting to things that are not email for certain corporations. I mean, number one, they are trying to look, unfortunately, far too few people, but more should be, trying to look at your list. If you do send to a lot of people at work addresses, looking at your list based on what domains, what ISPs and domains are filtering you. So if you say, gee, I'm looking at my open rate report, and this is a great one to look at, or your click link report, and look at it by domain name, and you notice that, gee, 100% of the email I sent to AOL, none of it got opened, or 100% of the email that I sent to everybody at this particular company that is a client of our, you know, a client or a prospect or whatever, none of it got opened. Then you know you've got a problem with that corporate filter, and you can actually, you know, if it's a client, call somebody over there and, or work something out with them. Maybe you can do an RSS feed. Maybe you can do a desktop app. Maybe you're going to send them a print version. Maybe you're going to get all their, you know, personal email addresses. Whatever it is, especially if you're in B2B and you've got a really limited niche universe and maybe there's 4,000 perfect people in the world to get your email, well, you better darn well be really watching by corporation, by email address, you know, anyone who's at, I don't know, Oracle.com or, you know, some whatever company you're trying to sell into, watching that and saying, oh, it looks like we didn't get in there. We actually did that a while ago, we found out that everybody at a particular publishing company, or it's a big publishing company called Connors, and for a while, not a single person who worked for Connors could get a marketing Sherpa email. And it was obvious it was filtered at the corporate level. And I believe customer service called over and said, hey, and got the thing lifted. Somebody in the IT department saw the word marketing and went, ooh, that must be bad email. It's sad that, what was it, something like 18% of marketers ever look at a report seeing open rate or click rate by ISP.
That's right.
To sort of spot the filtering. I would think that would be a very easy way of spotting stuff if you do look at it.
It is. Another basic tactic that isn't being used very often is simply asking people to whitelist your email domain. It works, and it... I do not see examples of it in day-to-day emailing very often.
So is it included in your welcome message? Is it included on the screen?
Exactly.
If someone signs up online, is the very next screen saying, thank you so much, please whitelist me.
That's right. It's those it's those little things up front which can prevent a lot of a lot of headache down the road.
You know, a company with a great example of this is a company called Daily Candy, which is available at dailycandy.com. It's actually a business-to-consumer newsletter, and if you go there and you sign up, and we have no relationship with them, so there's no reason I would recommend that, but except for the fact that they're fun. But if you go there and you sign up, I believe the very next screen, if you're in AOL, will say, by the way, here's if you're in AOL, here's how to whitelist, or if you're in Hotmail, it'll say, here's how to whitelist. And they actually show you little pictures of how to whitelist yourself and then give you instructions depending on what email address you put in. I remember seeing that about 6 months ago, and it should still be up there. I thought that was very clever. I believe that Smarter Living, which I believe is changing their name to Smarter Travel soon, smarterliving.com was doing something like that as well to the new people, zapping them off a welcome that gave instructions depending on what email address they they stuck in and said, okay, here's how you do it. Because you can't just say, please whitelist me. I mean, if I told my mother to whitelist me, she wouldn't have a clue. But
that's
if I said,
absolutely right.
Mom, here's a picture of the whitelisting screen. If you click on that button, oh, okay, you know, there you go. And, hey, that's what HTML is for.
You're absolutely right.
Why don't we move on
to yeah.
Page number 10, which is the value of verified opt-in users. Now, define verified opt-in. Is that the same thing as double opt-in?
It sure is.
Okay, and what is double opt-in, just for those of us who aren't quite sure?
Quite simply, instead of when I go to your website and I sign up for your newsletter, instead of sending me just a welcome to our newsletter message, you send me a confirmation link. And I have to click on that, and I'm then double opted in. I am double confirmed.
Now, the thing that annoys me is some people say, yes, especially when you're renting a list, they'll say, this is a confirmed email address. And that terminology doesn't always mean it's a double opt-in. I've questioned some people who claim to be running confirmed lists, and I'll say, well, what do you mean by confirmed? And they'll say, well, we sent them a welcome message, and it didn't bounce back.
Right, yes. It can refer to simply the validity of the email address, but mm-hmm. that's not really what we're getting at.
So it is that they said, oh, yeah, I really did mean to sign up, and they proactively clicked on that link.
Right, and what this chart shows is the dramatic difference between the two kinds of user. Almost three times as many of the non-verified opt-in users unsubscribed from a newsletter, and it should have been on this chart, but this is a 60-day unsubscribe study.
Mm-hmm. So 60 days of their lifetime on the list.
Exactly.
So it's the first 60 days of someone who is a brand new opt-in.
Right. They're AOL users, and uh-huh. they've been on a B2C list for 60 days. Fewer than 8% of the verified opt-in users have unsubscribed, while over 22% of the others have actively unsubscribed.
Mm-hmm. And I did notice that you have a factoid at the left about they're 33% less likely to click this is spam, the this is spam button. And I know that that is really a problem, because if you have too many people clicking that button, even if they click it by mistake, then you can be bounced off the whitelisted AOL and get in trouble there.
That's right. And AOL, in some respects, is not as much of a problem because they have an excellent department to deal with these issues. But some of the other ISPs can present more of an issue because they don't have personnel who are targeted with dealing with helping the marketer. They've got people who are responding to complaints, but they don't have the same emphasis that AOL does, to their credit, in making sure that some of the commercial emails that are improperly identified as spam get whitelisted. I've heard of examples where one person who complains five times has had an entire campaign filtered on one of the mid-sized ISPs with hundreds of thousands of subscribers.
Mm-hmm. That's scary. So yeah, you never know
right.
what they're going to.
Right. Well,
think
about the psychology
spam,
of the people who are picking up the phone.
Mm-hmm.
They're much more interested that their subscriber A gets off the phone and B keeps sending them $19 a month or what have you.
Then making sure my email gets through.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm not paying them. Why don't we move on to page 11? How marketers gather opt-in names. This is one of the biggest questions, because, of course, everyone knows that the value of a house list is so profound if you can get it, because house names always outperform any other kind of list that's out there. The second best kind of list, of course, is your direct competitor's house list. So what surprised you in these results? These are real-life results of Marketing Sherpa readers who, I think it's over 2,000 Marketing Sherpa readers who explained how they're gathering their opt-in names. Was there anything that surprised you here, Stefan?
I don't know that it was so much surprising data as important data.
Mm-hmm.
One company that does a very good job of categorizing the quality of the various kinds of subscribers they get is Topica. And a chart that we have in the report quantifies the value of people by the various means in which they enter their system. And And that was very interesting to see how dramatically different someone who uses who's responded to, say, a sweepstakes, their long-term value as compared to someone who signs up for a newsletter is quite different and quantifiable.
What I'm also interested in is the fact that it looks like offline is becoming a bigger factor in terms of people gathering names offline, which sort of alarms me because it's much harder to quality control as a marketer that name collection offline. I mean, if you've got, you know, clerks at 32 or 400 retail chains gathering the names, who knows whether they really explained it or not and explained it properly or not, or if you've got sales reps at the big trade show zapping badges, who knows whether that person really understood that their name's going to be gathered or not. So I think quality control is important there. The other thing that I'm concerned about with offline, and not that I don't think offline's great, but there is one other concern, and that is if you ever are accused of being a spammer and you need to get yourself off a major blacklist, and sooner or later we're all going to be in a blacklist, it happens, you need to be able to prove that you gathered that name with permission. If you can send a link, you know, to your online form saying, look, you know, we're double opt-in, and look, here's our form, and look how, you know, beautiful it is, and it really is permission, and very clearly permission, and blah, 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 the blacklist is much more likely to let you off the blacklist, and you're going to be fine. If you've got to dig around and find, you know, a 3x5 card somebody filled out at, you know, Burger King, or did you even keep the files? Are they somewhere in a data entry, you know, building or a warehouse in Dublin where you paid for cheap data entry? Where are they? Are they in India? You know, how are you planning on keeping all of that evidence? I know that some companies, in particular pharmaceuticals and financial services firms, are extremely concerned about keeping complete records of permission, no matter what type of marketing activity it is, for every single name on their file. So they're going to keep a record of fax permission, of email permission, of call me, and all the different permissions they've got from that person. If you're getting something offline, what is your system to keep a copy of that record in a way that can be gotten at pretty easily? Are you turning into, is somebody, I was going to say microfilm, but hello, it's 2005. You know, are you actually, you know, scanning it in somewhere? How is that working? I think it's a big issue for the future. Why don't we move on to number 12?
Sure. One other point I wanted to make on the how people are gathering names is that in terms of the willingness of people to give their name, we're not seeing a real drop in that, despite all of the worry about clutter in the newsletter space, spam, et cetera. People who have established newsletters and ones that are coming online now are not seeing a dramatic drop in their willingness of people to subscribe.
That's wonderful.
This is an interesting chart.
Page 12, the errors and campaigns to rented email lists. Yeah.
Yeah, let me give a quick explanation of this chart, which is probably not self-explanatory. This refers to the 12% of rented list email campaigns that were found to have errors in them. And this is a company called Emerging Audit, and they've got a very interesting technology that sort of piggybacks along with the rented emails as they go out.
Now, were these
lists.
I'm assuming because they were audited lists and they were rented emails, these weren't like slimy spam lists. These were pretty darn good lists.
I don't want to say best in show, certainly, but reputable, absolutely.
Okay, these are reputable lists.
Yes, I mean, that 12% figure would be radically different with
in the
some
slimy
lists
ones
that are out there, as we know. And so even among these good list companies, the thing that they find hard to deliver on is having database selects be accurate.
Oh, so, God. And, you know, the database select is the number one thing that's going to affect your response rate. I mean, that's more important than your creative.
Absolutely. One of the we collected a good bit of expert information on the rental list front. And
mm-hmm.
One of many sort of factoids was, or pieces of advice from people that do this every day, was on the B2C side, just stay away from selects. That unless they're getting thrown in as part of a package deal. And of course, this is a very strong negotiating time for the buyer, because of the weakness in the market. But that selects are simply are not worth any extra money
because they're not being done right.
Because
selects can be so powerful. I mean, saying
yeah,
I don't
the,
want
the,
all women. I want all women just in Florida, or you know, I mean, come on, a select, you know, or I just want women aged 24 to 25. I mean, selects are all that rules when it comes to really making a list powerful.
I think the underlying message was you shouldn't have to pay for it on the B2C side.
But you do pay for it. If you're renting a list in direct mail, like a snail mail postal list, you pay for it. That's standard. That's part of email lists. Oh, sorry, part of postal lists.
That's right. But it's a very competitive environment today.
Ah, and you can actually get away without paying for it. Is there any way of finding out whether your select was accurate? I guess just using the audit. That's why they're trying to sell the audit.
Well, I mean, you could, to a certain extent, you can... Mm-hmm. Do a limited kind of monitoring on your own by establishing email addresses that fit the select.
Right, and planting them on a list that you may use. And
seeding is is great in this space because you can do it yourself to some extent.
Plus, then you see how many of your competitors are selecting the same,
exactly.
same thing.
Exactly.
That's always fun.
We should probably move on.
Yeah, page 13.
And
when to send emails. We get lots of questions on this.
I was amazed. I would say that the third most popular question type that we were sent today was about this very issue, and the main point here is not that everyone should switch to Mondays, which, as you see, has the highest click rate in the work week. Rather, that this is a variable worth testing. There have been several studies, one by EROI that we reference here, and then a study into deliverability by day of week by Return Path. Mm-hmm. Both of them point to Mondays as being sort of underutilized by marketers, but it's important to remember that that Mondays have by far the lowest percentage. I guess Fridays are lower, but have less
Fairly
than
less.
A quarter of the sends that the middle of the week gets. And so it's not an apples to apples comparison. Nonetheless, there are real differences in response rate, and it's absolutely worth testing.
Now, the one thing I think that I'd like to know more about on Monday is I think a lot of people who have started sending on Monday recently, since this data came out in August, have started at 9 a.m. They're like, oh, that's great. Let's get a jump on it. Let's do 9 a.m. ET or 10 a.m. ET, and we're gonna grab, you know, Monday by the horns and make money from it. And, of course, the thing I worry about is I know when I get in from the weekend, I usually get, well, of course, I get an insane amount of email, but I usually get, you know, spammers go insane over the weekend. And you're anyone coming into the office is going to have a big honking fat pile of spam sitting in their inbox Monday morning. So the last thing you want is for your email message to be stuck in between 18 or 1800, spam messages, and it's just one of many. And if it's someone who is East Coast and they get into the office at 5 minutes after 9, you're still stuck in there in the big honking pile of spam. Or if they're Pacific Coast and you sent it at 9 a.m. East Coast time, but they're in California and they get into work at what would be noon your time, again, you're stuck in the big honking pile of spam. So if you're going to be sending on Monday, you really should be considering time of day for Monday and perhaps testing. Does 9 a.m. work better? Does 9:30 work better? Does 10:30 work better? Really almost any time up until about 2:30, 3 p.m. East Coast time on Monday. The reason why I say 2:30, 3 p.m., I've seen a lot of data. It's anecdotal. It's marketer by marketer, not dozens of marketers, but definitely more than five marketers who've all told me, who are heavy emailers, who have told me the minute you mail past 3 p.m. ET, in particular to a B2B list, but even to a B2C list, depending on demographic, you're losing response rate. There's just sort of an arc, and after about 3 p.m., they're not opening and responding the same way that they used to earlier in the day. And, you know, if you're sending something, especially that requires long reading and it's for business, or you have a long article in it, and you're sending it at 5 p.m. or 4 p.m., you're just not going to get your read. And, you know, work on earlier of the day or skip a day. It's better to send perhaps Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. than Monday at 5. So time of day can be as important as day of week.
Absolutely true. And I would, just to play devil's advocate, I would say that it's worth testing even those times that you feel sure aren't going to work because, you know, this was the conventional wisdom about Mondays was well entrenched. And there are a few studies which indicate that perhaps it was jumping the gun. So test. That's my only addendum.
That's great. One person, by the way, told me that the best possible time, if you are mailing sales reps, in particular if you're doing like an in-house mailing to reach your, you know, out-of-house sales reps, that Friday afternoon is the best time to send that because they're actually the only time they're going to sit down and look at their email.
That's a great piece of advice.
Now, let's move on to the last slide.
And I think we've largely
14.
Touched upon the lessons and conclusions here, and I don't want to repeat ourselves, especially since we have a few questions to get to inside of our hour. But one thing we haven't touched on is investing in metrics. One thing that I see occurs to a lot of marketers is because email is an inexpensive marketing medium, because email is a rapid response medium, it doesn't necessarily get the respect at the C-level that it deserves. Even though it's doing the yeoman's work of marketing departments, there is often not the investment in providing the kinds of long-term metric knowledge about what's happening with email campaigns. And of course, it's a catch-22 because the more information you have, the more arguments that you have to get more budget. So,
No, but when you say invest in metrics, I mean, aren't the metrics that you get from your broadcast firm or your email program enough? What additional metrics would you say people need?
Well, let's just remember that most people aren't using external partners. I would agree that those companies can provide you with an excellent breadth of metrics, but the majority of marketers are using in-house systems. Those in-house systems vary tremendously, but when you see, for instance, that only 18% of marketers are looking at deliverability by ISP, you know that those are not people who are using the professional ESPs of the world.
Well, the other thing I think that people often don't invest in is tying their email metrics to anything else. So they sort of are judging their email campaign in a void. They're saying, well, we've got a lot of opt-ins and we've got, got a pretty good open rate and it seems to be look pretty good, compared to marketing Sherpa averages. And it looks like we're getting pretty steady clicks compared to average. So that's what we're tracking. And if you ask them, well, how is this translating into a sales lead? Is it a qualified sales lead? Is it a non-qualified sales lead? Or how is it translating into actual sales? They say, oh, well, we're not tracking it to the cart, or whatever. And I'm not seeing, in particular for house lists, I'm not seeing the kind of tracking all the way through on the website that is really going to help you get a better budget. In particular, if you do want to get that budget for stronger landing pages, you're going to need some metrics to back it up to be able to go to prove to your CEO and CFO, oh my God, look, this is worth it. We're only getting 2%. If we can just add on 1% more, then we could make so much more money.
Exactly.
But you need to be able to track that and know what's happening on your landing page. And that is an email metric. Now, what about unsubscribe rates? I saw a lot of questions from people saying, what's up with unsubscribe rates?
Right. Unsubscribe is a metric that has limited usefulness. It can act as a benchmark, but I know you and I have discussed the validity of unsub rates and that marketers can get off on the wrong foot or stay on the wrong foot by looking at unsub rates as indicative of either response or the quality of what they're mailing.
Mm-hmm.
Because very frequently people don't unsubscribe. When they don't want something, they simply delete it.
Right. And I know that there was a study out there from, I'm forgetting their name, but it was last year, and they showed that the vast majority of people don't bother to unsubscribe. They just stop opening. They just start deleting, or they actually set a personal filter to get rid of you.
Right. I mean, we did find there is an interesting relationship between some of the biggest brands out there and unsub. they will typically see higher unsubscribe rates because they have the level of trust with the consumer that an unsubscribe really gets them off the list.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. There is still that old wives' tale out there that you know, if you unsubscribe to a list you don't know, that'll add you to a spammers list, which is a complete, it's an urban myth, but it's very well, it's believed.
Right. So there were a couple of other questions. The vast majority of questions we received were about response rates in different circumstances, and I hope we've addressed some of those. Filtering, as we touched on already, got a lot of questions, and some very specific ones, including what happens if I use the word free, what happens if I use the word mortgage, for instance. And we actually ran some of those specific tests with Pivotal Veracity, was a great partner, and just a few examples to show you how important it is to monitor filtering by the ISP. We used the word advertisement in the subject line and suffered no filtering whatsoever. But the abbreviation ADV and the emails were filtered by both Microsoft MSN and by AT&T. You know, massive reduction in delivery. The word mortgage. If you used it, we used it at the beginning of the subject line. There was three of the top 10 ISPs filtered it.
Okay.
At the beginning of the subject line. And at the end of the subject line, no problem.
Okay. Well, this has been fascinating. We now we're being booted out of our conference line room, so we do have to go. But thank you so much for joining us today. Stefan, that was fascinating information. I know that if anyone does have a specific question that wasn't addressed, you will find a table of contents for the metrics guide following in your handout. You may find the answer in there. If the answer is not anywhere in there, please, please email Stefan, that's STFANT@marketingsherpa.com, so he can make sure to start researching it for next year's edition. And if he does have an answer handy off the top of his head, he'll zip it over to you. Want to thank everybody for coming today. Have a great evening. Good night.
Good night.